Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest for both hours today. So it's going to be a fun one. The very popular Joe Heschmeyer is what I should say. The internet personality Joe Heschmeyer from Shameless Popery, which we just hear so many people say how important Shameless Popery is to them. So you should check it out. But you know what? Another option for you is just hang on for 2 hours because we've got Joe right here for the next 2 hours. Joe Heschmeyer, author, apologist, and proprietor of Shameless Popery. Welcome.
It's good to be here. I think people are going to worry that you've gone like fever delusional because you were so kind to me, but we'll see.
I know it does seem it can't last. Like there's no way it can last. Like we're going to be together 2 hours. I cannot. I don't think I've ever been nice to you for two straight hours in all
on
the time that I've known
air.
You. So it can't last. So maybe I am a little fever delusional. All right. Tell them what you do at Shameless Popery. People should know what's going on at Shameless Popery because Joe, really, I'm not trying to be nice to you. I'm really not. But it's extraordinary to me how many people have this has become their go-to thing. And it's not like you've been doing it for 1,000 years, but it's become their go-to place.
Yeah, I'm really honored by it. So the goal of Shameless Popery, in many ways, just the goal of Catholic Answers, is to answer objections people might have to Catholicism. And to try to show the truth, the goodness, and the beauty of Catholicism to people who are curious. And that leaves a lot of ground. That means there's a lot of topics that we can cover, and it's a lot of fun to get to do it.
You can check it out on on the YouTube channel. You can check it out wherever you get your podcasts, or just type in Shameless Popery to your machine, and you will come to it. The number's 888. No, I can't give out the number. Look at that. Look at I already messed up, Joe. We haven't even gotten to the first question. All the questions are in.
Exhibit B, that you might be suffering from some kind of feverish delusion.
I sound like a person with a feverish delusion, although.
That really should have been a good day, right?
I don't feel ill. I apologize for my Brenda Vaccaro voice. You have to be my generation to know who Brenda Vaccaro is. But in any case, let me give you a question, and then I can stop talking and you can start talking, which is what people want anyways. Ansley, our good friend, we got to meet Ansley. She came out to one of our conferences, and I think we've known Ansley. She's been calling the show maybe since she was 11 or 12, and just a lovely person. And so she lives in South Carolina, and she had a pretty direct question, Joe. What is ecumenism?
Yes. So ecumenism, we want to make a twofold distinction. When we talk with people who aren't Catholic, there's two kinds. There's what's called interreligious dialogue, where we talk with people who aren't Christian. And then there's ecumenism, where we talk with people who are part of the broad Christian family, but aren't fully Catholic. And the term ecumenism comes from the Greek oikos, which means house. So it's other members of the household, as it were. But they're partially separated. We call them separated brethren. So some people wonder, you know, why do we do this? Like, why don't we just tell everybody that they're wrong? And there's plenty of room to do that. And it's not actually wrong to tell people that they're wrong when they're wrong, as long as you do it in a charitable way, as long as you're motivated by the truth and by the good of the other person. We're called to speak the truth in love. But one thing that sometimes gets overlooked, even by people who want to proclaim the truth boldly, is that there is a time and place to just learn what the other person already believes. And I think we can see this pretty clearly in Scripture. So, for instance, St. Paul, in Acts 17, when he's on Mars Hill and he's preaching to the Athenians, he quotes like pagan poets. So we know that Paul took the trouble to learn what did these pagans believe. And we know from St. Irenaeus's Against Heresies in 180 This was our best resource on what it was that Gnostics believed prior to the discovery of the Nag Hammadi Library in the 20th century. We didn't have many Gnostic texts, but Irenaeus did such a good job of just tracing what they believed before showing why it was wrong, that it's a good reminder that there is an important time and place to just listen. Hopefully, if you're listening to this show, you can relate to that experience of somebody attacking what they think you believe, religiously, politically, whatever it is, and it's just clear they don't understand it at all. Like, they just don't know what it is they're talking about. So one of the reasons we have ecumenism, one of the reasons we have interreligious dialogue, is so that when we're going to make critiques, they're coming from a place of mutual respect and deep understanding. So if you have a deep understanding and appreciation of what the other person believes, if you can recognize what they're getting right, it puts you in such a better position to address what it is that they're wrong on, where their view of reality is incomplete, or where their Christian theology may be going astray. So that's why we do both interreligious dialogue and ecumenism. Ansley, I hope that helps. Happy to hear from you if you want to call in and let us know what you think.
I'm not going to give out the phone number. I want. I have the habit of
doing it. Good on you.
I'm not going to give out the phone number. Ansley, thanks for the call. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, and it's a weird show today because Joe and I are getting along right from the beginning. So just hang around, see what happens. I'm fascinated by this. It's never happened before. Let's get a question in from Joseph in Texas. Joseph asked this question, but didn't stay. So why did Mary have to be immaculately conceived?
So she didn't strictly have to be immaculately conceived. When we're talking about this, there's what's called necessity and what's called fittingness. So there are things where God does it because it's the best way, but he didn't have to do it that way. So Mary could have been a sinner. There's no logical reason it would have been impossible, but it is more fitting for her to have not been a sinner for several reasons. And if you want a much longer explanation on this, Trent Horn has covered this. I also did an episode on this because I thought Trent's arguments were wrong at first. And then the more I looked into them, the more I realized he was absolutely right. So I have an episode that's just called I Was Wrong, Worse, Trent Horn Was Right. And I mean, hopefully people get that it's a playful kind of title. But it's true that there is a good reason for Mary to be immaculately conceived. And we can actually talk about several good reasons. One is there's a fittingness that God himself is coming into the world. In the Old Covenant, when the Ark of the Covenant, the Shekinah, the overshadowing glory of God, was made present, the Ark was so holy that people couldn't even touch it. And this was not about the Ark for its own sake. This was about the Ark as, if you want to say, the bearer of the presence of God. Well, Mary is the bearer of God. That is what Theotokos means, God bearer. We usually say mother of God, but it literally is bearer of God. She is bearing God in her womb. And so we expect her to be very holy. But we can say even more than that, a few different places. In paragraph 490 of the Catechism, it says, in order for Mary to be able to give the free assent of her faith to the announcement of her vocation, it was necessary that she be wholly born by God's grace. Now, that doesn't require automatically that she had to be immaculately conceived, but it shows why it's so fitting that she should be immaculately conceived, that she is being carried along by the grace of God to be able to give her free consent to the plan of God. And the important thing there is that grace makes you freer. It's not like she becomes a robot or an automaton or something. But rather, she has been preserved supernaturally from sin by being strengthened in the battle against sin. And Dr. Jack Mulder has done some really interesting work on this, where he suggests that this is fitting in terms of consent. So imagine if you've done something at work and it's a fireable offense, and then your boss approaches you and you know you could be fired in a minute, and then they make like an untoward proposition. In those contexts, there have been plenty of, I mean, this is a lot of the Harvey Weinstein scandals or any of these things where somebody's in a vulnerable or compromising position because of things like power imbalance. They are then proposition in a way where they say yes, but they say yes under a certain amount of duress. And so the idea is basically Mary, it's obviously different. It's a virginal conception and birth, but she's being asked to give of her own body to bear Jesus Christ. And if she's in a situation where, because of her sin, she could be struck dead at any moment and go to hell for all eternity, how free is she to say yes? And yet we see that she does. And I've actually heard Protestants claim Mary doesn't have to say yes. She's just told what's going to happen. But Mary does say yes. She says, let it be done to me according to thy word. It's very clear that Mary consents and that this consent is important. But her consent is less free if she's a sinner who doesn't have space to say no to this plan of God without risk of damnation. A good example of this is in Isaiah chapter 6. In Isaiah 6, the prophet Isaiah sees God in heaven. And rather than rejoicing, as he hears the angels cry out, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, the whole earth is full of his glory, Isaiah's response is one of terror because he knows he's a sinner. He says, woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. And God doesn't disagree with that. Instead, one of the seraphim goes to the altar and brings a burning coal, and he undergoes a little earthly purgatory. He purifies him by putting the burning coal to his lips. And he says, behold, this has touched your lips, your guilt is taken away, and your sin forgiven. And it's only at that point that he hears, whom shall I send and who will go for us? And he says, here I am, send me. And he's sent by God. He is purified so that he can give his free consent to God. Now, Mary could have been purified in the same way. But the point there is whether she was purified through this kind of purgation or whether she was, better yet, preserved from having sinned in the first place, there was this sense where it seems fitting or even necessary that she be freed from sin to be able to give her free yes to God. So I would suggest that there's something both logical and intuitive about that. So was it strictly necessary? No. Was it appropriate? Was it fitting? Is it more glorifying to God? I would say certainly yes.
Joseph, thank you for that question. Lots more drop calls coming up. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest, right back with more on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Check out EWTN's official YouTube channel.
Just follow the link on our homepage at EWTN.com or go to YouTube.com/EWTN.
Watch EWTN's live shows or today's homily from the Daily Mass.
Click the upload button to see our most recent clips.
You can also find all of EWTN YouTube content by clicking the playlist button.
It's all on the official EWTN YouTube channel at YouTube.com/EWTN.
Visit today.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. Drop calls today. And we got one of the nice things about the drop calls is we can kind of curate them a little bit. So we ask the calls that we find interesting, or we take the calls that we find interesting. And this one comes from Prentice, who at the time of the call was watching on YouTube from Gonzales, Louisiana. Prentice, I'm sorry we didn't get to talk, but this was the question that Prentice had to ask, or was about to ask. Galatians chapter 1, verse 8, Joe. It points to the apostles potentially failing to pass on the gospel in the early church. Is that correct? Is that a correct reading of Galatians chapter 1, verse 8?
No. It is clear from St. Paul's letter to the Galatians that two things have happened. First, Paul has accurately given them the gospel. And second, people have come along after this and led them astray. And he is very clear about this. He says, for instance, in Galatians 3, O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you, before whose eyes Jesus Christ was publicly portrayed as crucified? And then he asks him in verse 3, are you so foolish? Having begun with the Spirit, are you now ending with the flesh? So it's clear that they had the right gospel, but were turning from the gospel for a false gospel. And contextually, it seems that this was what was called the Judaizer heresy, this idea that you had to follow the law of Moses in order to be saved. And Paul condemns it in very strong words. And he says, going back to Galatians 1, start with verse 6, I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the gospel of Christ and turning to a different gospel. Not that there is another gospel, but there are some who trouble you and want to pervert the gospel of Christ. But even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel contrary to that which we preach to you, let him be accursed, or let him be anathema. Nothing in there suggests that the apostles actually were preaching this false gospel. We know that there were some people coming down from Jerusalem, some Jewish converts to Christianity, who believed in this heretical form of Christianity, and they were regularly rebuked. But none of the apostles are implicated in that. They're sometimes said to be of the party of James, including by Paul. He uses that kind of language. But James himself doesn't appear to have ever taught that. It's just people who liked James, or people who were in this kind of Jerusalem church who had taken over too much of their earlier understanding of the Mosaic law and treated it as if it was itself salvific and it was meant to be ongoing in the new covenant. So the point Paul is making in saying, even if we or an angel should preach that, is just to say, literally, no one can contradict this, because this is the gospel of Jesus Christ. He's not suggesting either angels or apostles are literally doing that. They wouldn't. But his point is that he's not just declaring this on his own. You know, this is not just his own personal interpretation of Scripture. He is giving what he's been given by Christ, which is why he refers to it as the gospel of Christ in verse 7.
Prentice, thank you very much for the question. This came from Al in Washington. He was listening on 88.1 FM. Al wanted to know, this is such a good question. So rarely is it asked, and I actually think Joe Heschmeyer is the guy to ask it. Former seminarian, former lawyer. I ask you in your capacity as all these former things, Joe, why is there a separation of church and state?
It's a great question. And it's a question that needs a little bit of unpacking, because we might put it in two ways. One is, why is there a distinction between church and state? And then we can think about the so-called wall of separation. Because what there shouldn't be is a separation of faith and morality from the public sphere. That in public and in legislation, morality should inform our vision of the law. And of course it should. Every law is an expression of morality. If you say the speed limit on this road is 35 because of the school zone, you're saying something about the relative importance of, you know, the health and safety of children compared to the relative importance of getting to work on time or speeding commerce along or something like that. You're making value judgments in every law you make, no matter how seemingly banal the law is. So I mentioned that at the outset to say a radical separation where I'll give you a great example. With abortion, Planned Parenthood sued the Catholic Church, attacking the tax-exempt status of the Catholic Church for the church speaking out in pro-life messages because they accused the church of being partisan and political. So allegedly, being pro-life is too political for the church. But if a politician tries to pass a pro-life law, they're accused of trying to create a theocracy. So it's allegedly too religious for politics, allegedly too political for religion. So you can be pro-choice, but if you're pro-life, you're not allowed to do that because something, separation of church and state. That's an idiotic and manipulative misuse of the legitimate distinction between church and state. And so a lot of people say, well, let's just get rid of the whole thing. But there is a legitimate distinction between church and state, and we see it in Scripture itself. Now, you can see this in a clear way when Jesus is presented with the question about paying taxes, and he asks whose image is on the coin, Caesar's, and he says, render unto Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and render unto God what belongs to God. The mistake would be imagining that this means that the secular realm, the realm of Caesar, is entirely distinct from the realm of God, and that would be a mistake. In fact, that would be a very grave mistake, because Jesus also tells us that we can't serve two masters. So you can't just imagine we've got these two masters, we've got God over here, and we serve him on Sunday, and we've got Caesar over here, and we serve him, you know, on the weekdays. That would be gravely wrong. And unfortunately, many Christians, that's how they live their life. These are my private morals, but I'm not allowed to bring them into the workplace. I'm not allowed to bring them into politics. That's wrong, wrong, wrong. You're supposed to give all of yourself to God because you are made in his image. Just like the coin has Caesar's image on it, you have God's image. And so all of you belongs to God, including your financial transactions, including how you spend your free time, including how you are at work. All of that belongs to God. So then, how does this shake out in terms of the role of secular authority? There's three verses you should know about. The first is when Jesus is before Pontius Pilate, and Pilate says to him, this is John 19, verse 10. He says, you will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have the power to release you and the power to crucify you? And what does Jesus say in response? You would have no power over me unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin. That's the first thing you should know. All power, according to Jesus, or, you know, Pilate's power at least, is coming from God. And I think you can draw legitimately that this is true of all secular authority. That's true not just of Pilate, but of Caesar and of everyone else. That their authority, whether they realize it or not, comes from God to the extent they have legitimate authority. This point is made more explicit in Romans chapter 13. St. Paul says, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, he who resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. So we are called to obey legitimate secular authority. And then St. Peter in 1 Peter 2, verse 17, says, live as free men, yet without using your freedom as a pretext for evil, but live as servants for God, honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. And yet, this same Peter and Paul, make no mistake, are executed for refusing to obey unlawful orders from the emperor. That even though they talk about the need to serve the governing authorities, when the governing authorities violate the law of God, Peter famously says, we must serve God rather than men. That there is a higher law. Think about it this way. If you're a child and your parents leave and they leave the babysitter in charge, you obey the babysitter because the babysitter acts with the authority of your parents. But if your babysitter tries to get you to do something immoral and unlawful, you know your parents wouldn't want you to do that, so you don't do it. You obey in as far as they're using their legitimate authority. But you disobey if they violate this broader authority. So even though there's this distinct authority that the emperor has distinct from Peter, you know, Peter acknowledges it. Nevertheless, the authority of the emperor, like the authority of Peter, is subject to this higher authority, the law of God. And so if the civil authority acts in a way that contradicts the law of God, then we're not just free to disobey, we're even commanded to disobey if obedience would be sinful.
Who was that?
That was Al in Washington.
Al in Washington. Yes, Al, thank you very much for that question. The number here, I'm not going to give out because it's all.
What?
I. I'm sorry. That was like a tease. Like, oh, he's going to give out the number. I'm going to call and ask my question. No, we're not taking questions today because we already got all the questions in. It's drop calls this hour. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, and we've got about a million drop calls to get through. So yours are welcome. This one, well, I shouldn't say yours are welcome. They're
time now? Or are we about to cut to the break?
I was going to try Frank's question, but do you think I should? Frank was listening to Sirius, to EWTN on channel 130, Sirius XM satellite radio from Michigan. Is sacramental marriage possible without a civil marriage?
Yes. So the state should recognize legitimate marriage, but there's no, if you had a country that, for instance, didn't recognize a marriage, that would be fine in terms of you could still have the sacrament. There are cases, for instance, in the 19th century when slaves would get married, they could still have legitimate sacramental marriages, even though Jim Crow South didn't recognize slave marriages as legitimate, or I guess pre-Jim Crow. So you can have civil marriage. It's great if you do, but you can have a sacramental marriage whether you have the civil marriage or not.
Wow, well timed, Joe. All right, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more Joe Heschmeyer from Shameless Popery on Catholic Answers Live. All the calls are in. It's drop calls, so you know they're good. Coming right back with that after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Throughout history, some Catholics have been among the worst kind of villains, right? Or were they? In Canceled, historian Steve Weidenkopf digs into the lives and controversies of some of these Catholics whose reputations have been blackened, often unfairly. He takes on the anti-Catholic versions of history and defends not only these figures, but the faith they represent. Order your copy of Canceled today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
A little bit of groovy music for Joe Heschmeyer. Drop calls today. Hannah was in Washington when she called. She was listening on the Catholic Answers app. And I never mentioned this, but it's a cool feature of the app. You can get the Catholic Answers app, and then you're listening to the show, and a question comes up to you. You just push a button, and it takes you right into the studio. So it'll dial direct into here. And I don't know. In a lot of places around the world, it'll work, but here in the U.S., it'll definitely work. So get the app, and then when you have a question, all you push the button, and you're on with us. Well, almost. There's an intermediate step where Edgar sees if the question is appropriate for the air, but I'm sure it will be if you've got the app. Hannah was in Washington, as I said, listening on the app, and asked this: how do I discern the papacy claims on both the Catholic and Orthodox side, and which way to go? How do I decide? How will I know? She's asking the Whitney Houston question. How will I know?
I like that reference. Well, Houston, we have a problem.
Uh-oh. No. Oh. Why? I'm gonna act like that didn't happen. Okay, Joe. So How will she know?
It's a great question. So I actually address some of this in my book, Pope Peter, because the core answer I would give is that both Orthodox and Catholics want to be part of the church established by Christ. And both Orthodox and Catholics believe that church is a visible church 2,000 years old, and that we can find that church on the pages of Scripture. And then the question I think that remains is, within that visible church, did Jesus entrust one man to have a kind of final authority? Now, we don't need to know all of the contours of how that should shake out. Sometimes these Catholic Orthodox discussions get super in the weeds, and I don't think that's actually necessary or helpful. I would say, does Jesus leave Peter with a kind of unique authority, and does he intend for that unique Petrine authority to last in perpetuity? And I think we can say yes to that in several ways. Now, again, I cover this a lot more in the book, Pope Peter. If you want to check out that book, Hannah, I would tell you to stay on the line, but you're not on the line right now. So call back and we'll give you a copy. We're happy to do it. Let me just give you a couple places. So Luke 22, the disciples are arguing about which of them is the greatest. And Jesus doesn't tell them that it's wrong to want to be great or anything like this. He tells them how to be great. And he tells them that it's not like the way the Gentiles do it. They exercise lordship over others, and you know they want all this authority just for themselves. But not so with you. Rather, let the greatest among you become as the youngest and the leader as one who serves. So he's just given us the thing to look for. The leader is going to be one who serves, and he is himself the model. He says, I'm among you as one who serves. Now, in a sense, that applies to all of the 12. So what we just heard from, this begins in Luke 22, 24, and we're now down at 27. Then in verse 28, he says to the 12, you are those who have continued with me in my trials. As my Father appointed a kingdom for me, so do I appoint for you, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So, okay, all of them are called to be servant leaders for the entire church. They're to be the servants of God. But then in the very next verse, he singles out one of them. And he says, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you. Now, this is you plural. This is you all. That he might sift you all like wheat. But I have prayed for you. Now, he switches from the plural to the singular. So all 12 are under demonic assault. And the response of Jesus is to pray for one of them, Simon Peter. But I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned again, because he knows it will fail, when you have turned again, strengthen your brethren. So that's a papal model right there, that the Pope is to be the servant of the servants of God. Peter is to serve those who are called to lead by serving. He is to be the servant leader of the servant leaders. That's very plainly biblical. Pair that with things like Matthew 16, where Peter is uniquely given the keys of the kingdom of heaven and told individually, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. No other individual is told anything like this. And you see this all throughout the Bible, all throughout the New Testament, I should say. Every time the apostles are listed, Judas, if he appears, he's listed last. Peter is always listed first. And Acts, Peter in the 11 is how Luke refers to the 12 disciples. I mean, very clearly singling Peter out for this special place of primacy, special authority. Go tell his apostles and Peter that Jesus has risen. I mean, all of this kind of language over and over and over and over again. Peter is singled out, not just because he's like a natural born leader or something. No, because Jesus is putting him in these positions and giving him special instructions that he's to take care of the others. That's the model. And so then the question becomes whether this model was just meant for one generation or whether it's meant to last forever. Now, the first thing I'd say is certainly the burden of proof would be with the person who says, yeah, sure, sure, Jesus set up a papacy, but he didn't mean for that papacy to last beyond a generation. Well, show me some evidence of that, because normally, when Jesus gives some teaching, we assume that that teaching remains valid. But you can also make the positive case. Now, this probably takes more time than I should reasonably take to get in the weeds on this. But in John 21, there is It's kind of the epilogue to the Gospel of John. And Peter goes out fishing with six others. And he says, I'm going fishing. They say, we will go with you. And what you should know for this is that fishing and nets and boats, all of this represents the church and evangelization over and over and over again. In Luke chapter 5, with the first miraculous catch of fish, Jesus says to Peter, you'll be a fisher of men. Very clearly connecting the fishing miracle with evangelization. In Matthew 13, he compares the church to a net containing good and bad fish. In Matthew 17, there is a second miraculous catch of fish where Peter catches a fish with a coin to pay for just him and Jesus, their temple tax. And so there is this special connection with Peter, with the church, with evangelization, whenever we see these miraculous parable references to fishing, net, the catching of fish, all this. So we see the third miraculous catch of fish in John 21. Peter and the others are not able to catch any fish on their own, but at Jesus' command, they catch so many fish that they cannot bring in the nets. Peter then realizes that it's Jesus who had appeared on the shore, so he swims to Jesus. The others drag the net behind, but they still can't bring in it. In John 21, verse 10, Jesus says, bring some of the fish you've just caught. So Peter then goes aboard and hauls the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them. And we're told, although there were so many, the net was not torn. Now, there's two things you should know. First, in early Christian reading of this, people like St. Augustine talk about this, says that what's going on here is not, like, the point of John 21 is not to show that Jesus has risen from the dead. That has already been established in John 20. And in fact, John is very clear that he feels like that mission has been accomplished. In the end of John 20, he says, now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. And he says this right after Jesus appears to Thomas. He says, my Lord and my God. Meaning, the point of John 1 through 20 is that Jesus is who he says he is. He really is from God. He is with God. He is God. He lived, died, rose from the dead. John 21, this epilogue, is the story of the church. But as so often happens with John, it's the story of the church told almost like a parable, where he takes this event and wants us to think about what this means for the church. So here's the church on its journey to the eternal shores with Christ, which is why the number of apostles is seven, the number of perfection, the seventh day is the day of rest. As Hebrews says, when we go to heaven, we enter the Sabbath rest of God. Like, seven is the number of completion. So as we journey towards that, as we go from toiling with the nets and evangelization and the church, we're heading towards the eternal shores with Christ, where we're going to eat with him, the wedding feast of the Lamb, the breakfast in John 21. Peter has a special role. And what is that role? The apostles are not able to bring the church to Christ on their own. But at the word of God, at the command of Christ, Peter can bring those nets to Christ without the nets tearing. Here's the second detail to know, that the term there is schismo, which is where both schizophrenia and schism come from. And so he can bring the net to Christ without it tearing, if Peter is the one bringing it to Christ. And this is something that was not lost on the early Christians. St. Optatus of Milevis, writing in the early 300s, talks about the fact that there's only one apostolic see, Rome, because Peter has this special role. Because otherwise, if all the apostles could set up their own unique cathedras, you would have a bunch of schisms right away. You'd have people say, well, I follow Andrew or I follow Paul. And this is exactly what Christians are told not to do in places like 1 Corinthians 1. And so only one apostle, Peter, is viewed as having the church that has this ultimate authority, the way Peter had an ultimate authority. All the apostles are leaders. All the apostles have authority. And yet one of them is entrusted with a kind of final authority. And we see this as well in the writings of the earliest Christians. St. Irenaeus in 180 talks about the fact that it's a matter of necessity that every church should agree with this church, he's talking about the Church of Rome, on account of its preeminent authority. He's quite clear. This is not some new invention in the 11th century, as you'll sometimes hear from Orthodox apologists. Like, no, we find this in the second century. And I think you can even argue that we find it in the first century in things like the first letter of Clement. Then you look at things like, this will be the last point I make. I know I've spent a long time answering this. In 519, the formula of Pope St. Hormisdas settles an internal schism that was going on between the East and West. And if you read the text, it talks about the necessity of being in union with Rome, with the Apostolic See. And so what usually you'll hear in response to this from Orthodox, you can't deny this overwhelming weight of historical evidence. You'll often hear one of two things. One, oh, this is just honorific kind of language. And I don't think we see equivalent levels of honorific language. You can find inflated language used for other people, sure. But Rome is always treated in this singular kind of way. And two, they'll say, oh, well, Rome was Orthodox in its faith then, so then you did have to believe. But I think there's a certain naivety there, because obviously every heretic in history would say, oh, sure, we would have been in union with the Pope back when the Pope was right. But now that we disagree, we can no longer be in union with the Pope.
Yeah.
And so if the standard is just agree with the Pope unless you disagree with the Pope, that's a meaning. That is a truism. That's a meaningless standard that doesn't do anything to promote church unity, because it would only work until we're disunified. And the whole point is that we're given a standard for unity when we would be tempted to go in a different direction. In the same way that your wedding vows are not for when everything is going great in your marriage, it's for when things are hard and when you might be tempted to run. Well, so too, we're told to agree with Rome. We're told about the Apostolic See. We're told about the role of Peter, because sometimes we're tempted to run. Sometimes we're tempted to break away. Sometimes we're tempted to do our own thing. And it's precisely in those moments when our own private judgment would be, oh, well, I think Rome is wrong. That's when we're told to hold fast and to be part of this union. So I think the evidence is actually quite overwhelming. The very last point I'd make, Matthew 13, Jesus compares the church to a mustard seed that grows into a mustard tree, which is the largest of the plants of the garden. One of the points Jesus is very clear about is that it's going to be very easy to find the church because the church is going to be the biggest guy around. The Catholic Church is like four times larger than all the Eastern Orthodox churches put together. And the Eastern Orthodox churches aren't even really in full union with one another. So it's not hard, using the test Jesus gave, whether you look at Peter or whether you look at the mustard tree, to figure out where the true church is.
Anna, you asked the question of a guy who wrote a book about the papacy. You asked a papacy question. You got yourself an answer there, Hannah. I hope that was helpful to you. I heard some music, so I think Darren wants us to go to a break. Let's take a quick break. Right back with more Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
You could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Happy Easter. If you're a brand new Catholic, welcome. If you're returning to the faith, welcome home. EWTN Radio brings you Catholic Radio's premier shows, along with the leading voices of Catholic Radio, including Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers, Dr. David Anders, Father Mitch Pacwa, and Dr. Ray Guarendi. EWTN Radio, your source of truth that allows Catholics to grow in their faith and recognize the true mission of the Catholic Church.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. I mentioned Joe's got a book about the Pope, Pope Peter. He's got The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. He's got The Eucharist Is Really Jesus, which that title is so clear. And then Joe pays it off in the book that there's so many people who have been like, oh, The Eucharist Is Really Jesus. That's the one that got me, that convinced me. Oh, I get it now. It's like the light went on for a lot of people with that book. So you can get all of Joe's books over at shop.catholic.com. They're not all as good as Eucharist Is Really Jesus. I'm not saying that, but you can get them all there. I just can't do it, Joe. I can't just praise you.
You laughed.
I was so close. Huh?
44 minutes. That was, I think, a new PR.
All right. On we go. Let's see. Well, Chris in North Carolina, he asked this. Chris wanted to know, what are the last two declared infallible doctrines of the Catholic Church?
Yeah, that'd be the Assumption of Mary in 1950 and the infallibility of the Pope in 1870. The Immaculate Conception is 1854, if you want the third one. There are other things that the Church has arguably declared infallibly, but they're not doctrine. So the general view of theologians is that when the Pope canonizes a saint, that that is an infallible act. You will find some people who say that it's not. But the language sounds like the language of an infallible declaration. You'll also find things where we reiterate existing infallible teaching. The clearest example of that, I mean, in one sense, anytime you proclaim the gospel, you're reiterating infallible teaching. You know, when you quote the words of Jesus, that you're doing that in a way. But John Paul II used his authority as Pope to affirm that the question of women's ordination to the priesthood had already been settled definitively and infallibly in the negative, that women could not be ordained to the priesthood. So he made it very clear, using his authority as Pope, that this was the infallible teaching of the Church. But he also was clear that he wasn't declaring some new doctrine, that this was already the infallible teaching of the Church. And he was just using papal authority to clarify any confusion on that point.
Okay. Thanks, Chris, for the question. Let's see. John in Colorado was watching on Twitch. Would Christotheotokos be more correct than Theotokos?
Not more correct. It would also be correct. So,
okay, you got to explain some Greek here.
Okay. So the controversy when the whole Theotokos thing, I actually mentioned Theotokos earlier in this hour, but Christotokos was a proposed term for Mary, which means Christ bearer or mother of God. And this comes up in the Nestorian controversy. The response, so Nestorius and those who are in kind of the Nestorian camp said, we shouldn't call Mary the mother of God. We should call Mary the mother of Christ. We shouldn't call Mary the God bearer. We should call her the Christ bearer. And you'll sometimes hear Protestants who make this same argument. And this argument is wrong. The argument's wrong for basic Christological reasons. That Jesus is God. And that when you bear a child, that does not mean you originate all of their properties. This is, I mean, the usual argument goes, well, Mary didn't give Jesus his divinity. That's okay, so what? When a woman gives birth to a baby boy, she didn't originate his masculinity. That's not what we mean. Like, mother doesn't mean a sole originator of or anything like that. That's just not what the term means.
Well,
so it's an incoherent biological objection. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I got excited and I wanted to ask you a question. Like, yeah, like my mother didn't give me my soul.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So this objection just doesn't make any sense. Your mom is your mom, and significantly, your mom is the mother of you. She's not just the mother of your, you know, body or something like that. She's not just the mother of your humanity. She's not the mother of a nature or a property. She's the mother of a person. Jesus is a divine person. He's not a human person. He's a divine person with a human nature. He is God. He's the second person of the Trinity. And if you understand that, and then understand that this person has a human mother because of the incarnation, because he chose to have a human mother, then you realize that if you're going to say Mary's the mother of Jesus, then you have to be willing to say that she's the mother of the Lord, meaning that she's the mother of God. In Luke chapter 1, when Elizabeth greets Mary in the visitation, she refers to her as the mother of my Lord. This means the same thing as when Thomas says, my Lord and my God. So Luke 1:43, she says, why is this granted me that the mother of my Lord should come to me? Now, Lord, Kyrios, is the term that the Jews would use to refer using the unspeakable name of God that God revealed to Moses. And so as a way of speaking in a kind of deferential way, anytime that gets translated into Greek, we'll find that translated as Kyrios, which means Lord. And so when she says, mother of my Lord, that this means mother of God. That's what it means in context. And so to say that Mary is not the mother of God, you'd have to say either that she's not really the mother of Jesus or that Jesus isn't really God. And both of those are obviously false, obviously heretical. So is Mary the mother of Christ? She is. That's actually not in dispute. But we refuse to be limited to calling her the mother of Christ instead of the mother of God, because we want to stress that she's not just the mother of a nature, she's the mother of a divine person. And that this divine person is, as the term divine person suggests, he is God. And so it's to protect Jesus that we protect these Marian titles. Because if you get this messed up, if you get this confused, and I've seen prominent Protestants get this wrong, then you end up having a very poor Christology.
All right, John, thank you very much for the question. Let me just look at the time. Yeah, we got time for another one. Matthew in Texas was listening to EWTN on Channel 130 Sirius XM satellite radio. Why do people think the church was started in the 300s?
I mean, one answer would be people don't know church history very well. But
they haven't read a book. There's a certain book that they have not read. That's what the problem is, Matthew. There's one book they have not read.
Yes, I read a book called The Early Church Was the Catholic Church that looks at Christianity prior to the year 200. So in the first century and in the second century, what does Christianity look like? When we listen to those Christians in their own words, what do they say? Because you can find a lot of people telling you what those Christians believed. I just responded to a video from a Protestant who's big on TikTok claiming, oh, all of this Catholic stuff was introduced by the Emperor Constantine when Christianity was legalized, and this all comes from paganism. This is a very common, very obviously false story. The true part, Constantine legalizes Christianity in the Roman Empire. It had been illegal prior to that point. The false part is this claim that then all of the Christians just embraced all these pagan practices. It's a very silly story for an obvious reason. These Christians were being killed for refusing to compromise with paganism, and now we're expected to believe that they all were just like, well, I guess if you legalize Christianity, we'll all just compromise with paganism. The whole reason it was illegal is that the Christians refused to do that. So this story, a lot of people are convinced by it, but when you read the actual documents, here's what we find. Number one, we don't find that Constantine introduced any new doctrines. Constantine didn't even get baptized until his deathbed. He legalized Christianity. He wanted Christians to be coherent in what they believed, and so he does arrange for the First Council of Nicaea. The First Council of Nicaea doesn't do half the things you've heard that it did, and you can find this out for yourself by reading the very clear canons of the Council of Nicaea, First Council of Nicaea, which they don't, for instance, take a bunch of Gnostic or other books out of the Bible. That's just not true. They don't decide which books belong in the Bible. That's not a thing that they did. If you've heard those stories, those are just not true. So we don't see any like major changes in the 300s to some new doctrines. It didn't happen. We don't see a bunch of, you know, pagan temples in Rome becoming churches overnight. That is a popular story. Doesn't really happen. Some of those pagan temples become churches hundreds of years later. But they actually made it, the early Christians made a point of not just having to go from one week it's a pagan temple and the next week it's a Christian church to avoid any kind of confusion. So a lot of the churches in Rome that had been pagan temples became secular buildings for centuries and then later were turned into churches when there was no longer any risk of conflation with paganism. So the kind of popular story about this is just wrong. And again, I would say you can read my book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. You can also just read the writings of the early Christians who were very clear what they believe about the Eucharist, about, you know, the saints, about the role of the bishop, about all these things that allegedly come from paganism, very clearly don't come from paganism. And so, unfortunately, there have been some, I would say, honestly, kind of absurd books. Alexander Hislop's book, The Two Babylons, claimed like all the distinctive elements of Catholicism were introduced from paganism. And no scholar, secular or religious, takes that seriously. Like, you just cannot trace any of those things. So if you hear somebody claiming this, here's what I would suggest you do. Number one, ask them for evidence and ask them for evidence from the early sources. And then number two, read the early sources yourself and you can see that these things aren't true.
Hey, if you call back sometime, Matthew, I'll give you a copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Never mind the year 300. Joe handles before the year 200. He doesn't even bother. Like, let's go back before the year 200, and you can recognize the Catholic Church there. So from the very earliest years. Joe, thanks for the hour. Will you do another hour with us?
I'd be happy to.
All right, I promise to be nice for another hour. I feel like I'm really bringing it off. That'll do it for us for this hour, but we got lots more drop calls coming up right after this on Catholic Answers Live.